live stream both video and audio on, well, if you're on Twitter, you'll be able to define the hashtag or the URL for that. My name is Luke Walzer. I'm the Assistant Director for Educational Technology at the Schwartz Communication Institute. This is the first in a series of events that we're hosting to give people who you learn a lot from opportunities to talk to us about innovative pedagogy. Next Wednesday evening will be an event on DIY web radio. Jim will be back for that. Michael Branson-Smith from York College will be here. Grant Potter will be here from University of Northern British Columbia. And Gina Garcia from the University of Connecticut will be here as well. And Mikhail will moderate that event. Okay. And then we're setting up an event which is tentatively scheduled for November 21st with Gardner Campbell to come speak to us about digital citizenship. There's one other event that I'd like to draw your attention to. That's an event from the CUNY Digital Humanities Initiative next Tuesday evening at the Graduate Center at 6:30 p.m. That will be it's Mark Sample and
Shannon Matin
from the New School. Mark Sample's from George Mason University. And they'll be speaking about
digital humanities in the classroom.
Very kind of focus on pedagogy at the intersection of digital work. So that's 6:30 next Tuesday, room
something on the sixth floor.
On the sixth floor of the Graduate Center. Okay, so there's a lot going on at CUNY. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Mike Neary and Joss Wynn and Jim Groom to speak with us today. Mike and Joss are from the University of Lincoln in the UK. Mike Neary is the Dean for Teaching and Learning and the Director of the Center for Educational Research there. And Joss is a senior lecturer at the Center for Educational Research. They're going to speak to us today about their project, The Student as Producer. And our old friend Jim Groom from the University of Mary Washington, where he's an instructional technology specialist, is also going to be speaking up on the topic of student as producer. And we'd like to welcome them. Look forward to their presentation. Mike and Joss are going to go first. Jim's going to follow, and then we'll open up for discussion.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good. Great. Thank you for inviting me and us, the three of us. It's a great privilege and a pleasure to be here talking to you about our work. Let me tell you something about the plan for the talk. In my role as the Dean of Teaching and Learning, I'm going to talk about the structure and the infrastructure of how we're working to create this project across the whole university. It's an institutional-wide project, so I want to tell you something about the structure and the infrastructure. And Joss Wynn is then going to talk about one particular aspect of the infrastructure, which is technologies for education. And then Jim is going to do his own translation of the whole thing and tell you about the kind of work he is doing, which we know, because we communicate quite a lot, is very much in the way of student as producer. Okay, so that's the plan for the talk, and we hope to leave plenty of time for heated debate at the end. Let me tell you something very quickly about the University of Lincoln. University of Lincoln is a new university in England, in the UK. It's about 10 years old, and there's 12,000 students there, 10,000 undergrad, 2,000 postgrad. And because it's new, and because it's not too enormous, I think it provides a very good environment for innovation and experiment. And I think that's an important part of what Joss and I are going to say. Okay, so I want to make some introductory remarks before then going on to talk about how we're implementing student producer across the whole institution. My first point is that student producer at one level is, as I've said, a curriculum development program across a whole university. So it's very much about change at the level of institution. But my second point is that student producer is much more than that, we think. At a very fundamental and profound level, student producer is part of the ongoing project to reinvent the European university. students produce at this fundamental level is part of the ongoing project to reinvent the European university. And what I mean by that is part of a project to reinvent the production of knowledge and meaning as a progressive political project. My third point is that Students Producer has emerged out of the meaning and Students Producer has emerged out of the crisis of the meaning and purpose of higher education. What we like to call in Europe and in England the idea of the university. So there's enormous confusion in the UK and Europe right now about what universities are actually for. And there is a debate ongoing that we have been engaged in for a good few years, but as more people are getting involved in this debate about the meaning and purpose of higher education. And this has emerged from the crisis. The crisis of higher education in the UK at a time when higher education is being increasingly marketized and commercialized. At a time when the model of a marketized social development appears to be on the point of collapse. So in the UK, there's increasing marketization and commercialization, increasing privatization of universities, education, and the health service, but at a time when, as we all know, feel, the marketized system of social development appears to be on the point of collapse. Okay. So Students Producer is the organizing principle of teaching and learning at the University of Lincoln. And it begins from a negative critique of the university. It begins from the dysfunctionality that is the core of higher education. And the dysfunctionality is the relationship between teaching and research. In the UK, there are about 140 public universities. They would all claim to be doing some research and some teaching. Many people in the UK feel that if a university is not research, then it's not a university, if it's just teaching. But we know, because we live it every day, that research and teaching work against each other. So Student as Producer is attempting to re-engineer the relationship between research and teaching, to find a way of linking them that makes it more productive for academics and for the student. So the student becomes a part of the academic community of the university. They become part of what we do across the whole institution. And the way in which we do that, fundamentally, is by getting more research and research-like activities in the undergraduate curriculum from the get-go, from the minute they walk in the door, as well as involving students in the design and development and critique of the curriculum. So it's re-engineering the relationship between research and teaching, but also involving students in the design and development of the university courses. Now, I know that in your university and in all universities, there's a great deal of this kind of work ongoing. There's a lot of students working with academics producing work at all levels. There's a lot of students working with academics and teachers to design the curriculum and critique the curriculum. But what no university has done is institutionalize it in the way in which we are doing it. And might I say also politicize it in the way in which we are doing it, as a part of the crisis of higher education. This is not just a nice teaching and learning, experimental, innovative teaching. It's about something much more profound than that. But teaching and learning and research is at the core of the whole thing. So what we do and what we have been doing for the last 4 years, since I've been at Lincoln, is challenging and inviting academics to get involved in the project. And we do this in the way in which we talk to academics and support colleagues and librarians and teacher developments and ed developers and students and senior managers. So we say these in senior management meetings as well. I'm the Dean of Teaching and Learning, so I'm in a good position to be able to have these kind of conversations at that level. The way in which we challenge and invite is by talking about the history of the university, the modern European university. Who are we? By intellectualizing the issue, which is what academics are, and by working with the infrastructure and redesigning and designing the infrastructure to make this work. So I'm just going to say a few remarks about those three things, then I'll hand over to Jos, who'll say more about infrastructure and technology. The first thing, history of the modern European university. When did a modern European university first appear? Well, you can say precisely when it appeared, I think. It appeared in 1810 in Berlin. William von Humboldt invented it as a progressive political liberal humanist project. It was, at the beginning, a political project to create Prussia and the new Europe in a liberal humanist, within a liberal humanist framework. And what's key about Humboldt's university is that it was designed with research and teaching together. Because the university for Humboldt was about the expansive production of knowledge. It wasn't just about teaching and learning. It was for Newman, we know that debate. It was about something else. It was a progressive political project against the dogmatic ancient university, which was about training scholars for the professions and the clergy and so on. Humboldt University was a response to the failure of the French Revolution. It was always a progressive political project. So we want to recover some of that. Get research and teaching back together again. Part of the failure of the liberal humanist project is that research and teaching have been torn apart and problematized, and as I said earlier, they have become dysfunctional. And the precise moment of the failure of the liberal humanist university and project can again be very precisely identified in a moment of 1968. And the moment in 1968 is the failure of the liberal humanist project, where students became not just students, but revealers of the general crisis. They wrote about it, they protested about it, they published. One of the slogans of the protest in that moment was, research is something that anybody can do. They demystified the idea that research was something that elite academics were only able to do. So we talk about that. And in Europe I say we're still in the moment of 1968. We haven't got beyond it. All of the progressive teaching practices we currently use were designed in that moment, and have now been mainstreamed in Europe. We also talk about the situation in the US in the 1990s, and we're very keen to talk about the Ernst Boyer Committee. And you know more than I know that in the 1990s, Ernst Boyer identified the problem in research-intensive universities was the dysfunctionality between research and teaching. And how could they re-engineer, or in his words, reinvent the research-intensive university by finding a way of bringing research and teaching back together. So we use that word a lot, reinventing, a lot, which we get from his committee, which was called the Reinvention Committee. And you know there's a program in Stony Brook University which is called the Reinvention. And we have done a lot of work with them over the years. So we talk about all of that when we talk about the history of the university with academics and students. Our second main point when we challenge and invite academics to get involved is we intellectualize the issue. We don't talk about teaching and learning in a sort of teaching and learning agenda, by which I mean how are students successful, or what are the best forms of teaching to make students successful. We talk about that a bit, and we have evidence for this kind of work, and it produces really good students, and they do really good things. So we use that, but that's not our main point. Our main point is to intellectualize and to radicalize, indeed, the whole issue. And by radicalize, all I mean is by talk the language of the crisis. The radical language is the language that comes out of the crisis. It's the articulation of the crisis. That's where it emerges from. So we use that. I am a sociologist. I'm a political sociologist. I'm interested in critical social theory. That's my subject. So I talk to academics in my subject about teaching and learning to try and encourage them to think about their own, their teaching and learning in the way in which they think about their research. And we use a lot of critical theory from the early and mid-20th century. And I'm going to talk about one person today in particular, Walter Benjamin. Walter Benjamin was a, how would you describe him? He was a messianic, modernist, Marxist, critical thinker and philosopher. And Walter Benjamin in the 1930s wrote a paper, Author as Producer. And he was writing this in a moment of crisis in the 1930s in Paris to the Committee of Anti-Fascists. And the problem he was addressing was, how do radical intellectuals act in a moment of crisis? And Brecht was very influenced by the Russian constructivists. Sorry, Walter Benjamin was very influenced by the Russian constructivists and Bertolt Brecht. And Benjamin's point was one way of reacting to the crisis is to attempt to encourage people who see themselves as objects of history to become subjects of history. In other words, to turn the audience into the performer, to turn the reader into the writer, and to turn the student into the teacher, so that students come to see themselves as subjects of a historical process. And if I would just point to the last paragraph on the flyer that we've handed out on this page, and this last paragraph is taken almost verbatim from Benjamin's work. The point is that the capacity for student as producer is grounded in the human attributes of creativity and desire, so the students can recognize themselves in a world of their own design. And my final point is to talk a bit about the infrastructure of the university before handing it over to Joss, because it's one thing to talk in critical theory and the history of the university, but it's very, very important to concretize and to bring the critical theory to life. So it's very, very important to find a way of designing the infrastructure of the university in a way that will support this process. So after a period of 4 years working alongside academics and students and their colleagues in the administration of the university, we have now redesigned the quality protocols, the administrative processes by which new programs are put forward and validated, and programs revalidated. And in the UK, programs are validated every 5 years, and new programs have to go through a very bureaucratic process. We have rewritten the protocols so they are in the way of students producing. So that's very important, and there's more that can be said about that. But now I'm gonna hand over to Joss, who's gonna say something about technologies for education.
good evening. I joined the Centre for Educational Research and Development a few weeks after Mike, and I joined in the role of what you may as well call educational technologist. I joined specifically to work on a university-wide project to set up an institutional repository. So from the very beginning, my work was not focused on technologies in the classroom, but on the kind of institutional level that affected research, teaching, and learning across the university. And that's really where I've stayed. I haven't really done very much around the use of technology in the classroom, but there are lots of examples, of course, across the university where teachers are using technology. And there's lots of examples where teachers are not using technology, and I prefer to kind of stay out of that domain and that question, really. My work is with the Centre, if I can just give you some context, the Centre for Educational Research and Development obviously has an institution-wide remit. Part of our work is to educate, to run a PhD in EdD program in education. Another part of our work in the centre is the teacher education program. Another part of our work is the EdTech, the kind of centre for educational technologies. When I first joined the university, shortly after Mike did, we started talking about Students Producer. And my background, my interest is very much in the what's generally called free culture, more specifically open source and in kind of education environment, the open education kind of movement. And of course, I joined the university to work on an open access institutional repository. So I always saw myself very much as an advocate for the values of openness, of collaborative working. And Mike and I started discussing this in the context of Students Producer while we were attempting to write a chapter called Students Producer for a book. To cut this short, the conclusion or the concluding section of the chapter drew upon the free culture movement as an example of the potential for technology to enable the values and the agenda of Students Producer. And we talk at the end of that chapter, drawing actually off the work of an academic called Nick Dyer Witherford, who wrote a book called Cyber Marx. And he talks about the potential of as you know, the internet, kind of networked communications, to flatten hierarchies, both inside and outside the university. So from that point onwards, in the work that I do, I've tried to develop that thinking and in very practical ways, develop how we build this notion of a commons in our university. And I'm aware that CUNY has the academic commons. I remember rightly, we both started, I think, almost at the same time in that area of work. I set up the Academic Commons at the University of Lincoln, and then I think within a few weeks, Matt Gold contacted me and he said, hey, we've just set up something similar. Actually, you've gone much, much further than we have in creating that community online. It's really very impressive to see what you've done. What the approach I've taken, because of our position in this centre that works across the university, I've tried to engage students in the work that I do. A lot of my work is project work that's externally funded through grants. In every case over the last 4 years, which has involved 7 or 8 projects, I've tried and been successful in putting students at the very centre of them. So what I want to emphasise is that these are research and development projects around the use of and role of technology for education. But the students are not my assistants. Actually, the students are critical to the work that we do. And without the students, the projects would not run. I rely very much on the experience, the skills, the enthusiasm, the energy that they can bring to the projects. I also work with, if I can just explain a bit more about how we're able to have this kind of, as Mike puts it, infrastructural impact. I work very closely with colleagues in the library, and in the central IT services. students producer should be emphasized. Although a teaching and learning project in many ways, is also affecting the administration of the university. As Mike was saying, it's affecting the bureaucracy, the kind of quality assurance, the curriculum development, you know, the committee meetings is in the language of students producer. So it's not just something that's affecting the experience between teachers and students, but it's actually having an effect on staff like myself that have very little to do with the kind of day-to-day teaching and learning. And to their credit, the library and the IT departments have taken on board the idea of engaging students in the work of the university, in what we talk about as the idea of the university, and have also employed... I should make this clear as well, that in many cases, in almost all instances, students have in some way been paid for the work that they do. We have a formal bursary and grant program that we provide to students, not only as an incentive to get involved in the research, but to support their work across the summer when they may otherwise go home. I work on funded projects, I can factor into the running costs of the projects, what it costs to employ a student as a freelancer, or actually as a member of staff. So there is this kind of strange blurring of roles where we've got students that are going off to class and then they're coming down and sitting next to me as a member of staff, effectively. So that's the way I work. That's the way that students are involved in my work. That's the way that students are having an effect on the way the university develops its use of technology to support research, teaching, and learning. One of the things which I just want to finish on, really, and I'm finding particularly interesting in my kind of more reflective time at work, going back to the free culture movement, when we first started thinking about this and talking about this, Mike and I, we looked at the free culture movement as something somehow outside of the university that we could bring in and that we could borrow from. And it seems quite obvious now, actually. Of course, the free culture movement actually is an academic movement at its heart. The history of hacking, the history of hackers came out of MIT in the late 60s. You've got the free software movement that developed in the 70s and 80s. The work that we do, that I do, involves software development. We talk about hacking and we talk about the students as hackers. We talk about hacking the university. And so we're starting to use the language of the free culture movement and bringing it back into the university. And in many ways, we're at the point now where we're trying to quite consciously and explicitly reclaim the values of the free culture movement as those of the university, that they're academic values. As I'm sure you'll agree, having run the CUNY Academic Commons, there's a great deal of overlap and history in the free culture movement and the modern post-war university. I'm going to stop there. We can talk about that a bit more during our questions. I'm going to hand over to Jim, who I see as one of the finest examples at the moment of hacking the university.
Wow. I've always liked you, Joss. Everybody, I'm going to actually sign in. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to take a second and log in and show you some examples. So it's funny, as Mike and Joss talk, and they talk about this idea of student as producer, we've been working, I'm from the University of Mary Washington, I'm an instructional technologist, my name is Jim Groom, and what we've been doing is, we've been kind of playing with this in the classroom. we've been using open source tools like WordPress, MediaWiki, etc., and not thinking about it kind of as abstractly, but just like what are the tools that will work so that students can actually take control of their work? Because it's interesting that one of the things that came out from the work we did is we worked in LMSs, we were kind of upset and kind of tired of Blackboard, and Blackboard's on its last breath, and we were kind of like this idea of why can't students control the work they do and take it with them? Why can't they have some ownership over the things they produce? Which goes back into this. Well, one of the things that Mike talked about, and I really want to kind of reinforce here, is this notion of the capacity for a student as producer is grounded in the human attributes of creativity and desire. And for us, that's really key. And what I'm going to show you is I'm going to show you some really interesting examples, I think, of a class that is trying to imagine what student as producer might look like in a creative situation like digital storytelling. Digital storytelling is this abstract concept. What does it mean? Right? The traditional idea of digital storytelling is like Joe Lambert's, which I don't want to make fun of, but it's kind of like, I was riding a bike with my dad, and it's at that moment I fell off the bike, and then I realized I scraped my knee, and then you have like the pictures of you riding the bike with your dad and the sound underneath, and then there's your digital story, and that somehow kind of bring out of you. But when we think about the web right now, the web is kind of infused with all these fragmented narratives in social medias that are narrating in totally different ways. I mean, think about the narrative that's happening in Occupy Wall Street right now. Mm-hmm. It's a completely distributed, fragmented narrative, and I love that the press can't hold on to it. Because they're trying to say, what do you stand for? Because once you tell us, then we can ignore it. Right. And when you don't tell them, and you don't articulate it in the same narrative way, it kind of challenges some of our assumptions about it. So one of the things we did in this class called Digital Storytelling, which is now kind of affectionately known as DS106, is we kind of tried to explode the idea that the teacher was going to be dictating what students did. I taught this class for 5 different semesters. And the first 2 semesters, I came up with like 8 assignments. And they were 8 great assignments. I thought, these are the best assignments, right? Of course, I made them. So we build these assignments, and they would do them, and that'd be the end of the semester. Well, what happened is we kind of opened up the production of the class. So we created a form, and any student, both either they were in the class or they were open online, because we had over 400 people sign up for the class who weren't even paying tuition, and basically submit any assignment they wanted. And what happened is we went from about 10 seated assignments to about 185 that we have now. And what's amazing is we don't tell students what assignment to do. They go in there and they choose. These are design assignments, these are visual assignments, do them. Something really interesting happens. We have a student, her name is, Colleen Trachy. Colleen Trachy came up with this, here's my own arrogance. Came up with this story. It's like, hey, it's called Poetry Playlist. Pick a number of songs from your playlist in iTunes or whatever it is and make a poem out of it. I'm like, that's the stupidest digital storytelling, and I was getting all kind of cocky. What happened is a week later, 60 people from all over the world did her assignment. She came into class, floating around, she was excited. People from Portugal, people from Australia, they had done her, for some reason, it had kind of infused them with some excitement. And so what we had is, we had this kind of open base where anyone could submit, and anyone could do anyone else's project, and we kind of architected it so that you could see who did what. And so what you start to see is you get this distributed class. Now, it doesn't stop there, and I want to get into the presentation a little bit just for some visuals to show you what exactly it looks like. So I'm just going to go to Google Docs for a second. So give me a second. I'm going to show you a little bit of what I'm talking about. And then hopefully I'm going to tie this back in to this notion of student as producer and try and make a cogent thought. But if I don't, that's my fault. And you can take me to task on that or buy me a drink, whatever you're interested in. Okay, so here we go. Okay, so I'm doing this, and I called it Student as Creator. That was just kind of like I kind of wanted to play off their title. And I'm just going to do a quick presentation. I'm going to go through some of this stuff very quickly. This is our framework. Talked about CUNY Academic Commons. This is UMW Blogs, which is an open source publishing platform where any student, any staff member, any faculty member can get their own space. They could do with it what they want. We've used it traditionally for course sites, but it became so much more. People started using it for personal sites when they studied abroad. They use it to communicate with their parents. People would use it to create sites to talk about their pets. We didn't care. And one of the things we did is we never said, this is how you use this site. We said, use it however you want. And that freedom was interesting because they showed us how to use it. I really loved. And they started also using it for research. And this kind of goes to Mike's point. We have several students now who took control of this space and were doing research projects, whether it be about the financial crisis and global recession that happened in 2008. We're still feeling the repercussions of. Interestingly enough, this is visited about 10,000 times a month by people all over the world. This is open research out there done by students, which really points to Mike's point. And we kind of came at this backwards. We wanted an easy tool to use that was open. And what happened is we started to realize that we're getting traffic from all over the world. Our students' research is being promoted because we're in a system that works well with the web. Now, one of the things that's interesting, does anyone have a device? Google Black Mountain Poets. This is my one assignment for you. You can do it or not. I won't grade it. I promise. Okay, if you Google it, what's the fourth link? You guys are very slow.
COPOF10UMW1.
Ooh, COPOF. That fourth link is a UMW blogs site that students created, and I would argue is better than the Wikipedia article. And that's what's really cool is you start to build stuff that go on the web and Google picks it up. Now, the king of this is John Beasley Murray, who did this out in UBC. He had his students actually work on existing Wikipedia articles and promote them, and some of them would get 100, 200,000 hits a month. And what they would do is they would build the actual bibliography. They would do the research and bring it back and talk about an open access application of teaching and learning and research. It really is a powerful project. It's called Murder, Mayhem, and Madness, if you're interested. I love the title. So there's the site. And one of the things that came out of this is this notion of not a room of one's own, to give credit to Virginia Woolf, but this notion of a domain of one's own. One of the things we push for at Mary Washington is every student should have their own space. Every student should do their work in that space, and it should syndicate into a core space or whatever. But when their time was up, they take their work and they take it with them when they go.
Mm-hmm.
Right, this notion that what you did here is yours. It's part of your archive. It's part of who you are. It's part of your process as an intellectual and as a thinker. And so what we started to see is students did. This student blogged for 15 different classes. What she was done, she exported it all out via RSS, and she created her own space. Space she owns. And it's quite attractive. Now, we have several students who are doing this, and that whole idea of what's an e-portfolio, what's not an e-portfolio, I'm not uninterested in that question. I want a student to have a space that they control and that they frame what they've done. And this is a space that doesn't necessarily have to live on our infrastructure. It can be theirs. And we can stream it in thoughtfully. That's why RSS was embedded in it. Now, this all comes out of an idea called the personal cyber infrastructure by Gardner Campbell, who will be speaking here, as you heard. And this notion is kind of simple. Make the students their own sysadmin of their education. Give them their own space. Give them their own web hosting. Let them set up their own domain and their own application and control what they do. And then the work they do feeds into a common space that anyone can access. Right? This notion is if you give the student a platform to create from, we can't predict the greatness they will bring to us. We don't dictate the work and the space within which they work. They control it. They build it, and they imagine it. Now, we go here. This is kind of the highlighted in orange is kind of the point I wanted to highlight from Gardner's article, although there's many. How might colleges and universities shape curricula to support and inspire the imaginations that student needs, which goes exactly to what the student is producing is trying to do on a curricula level. Trying to reimagine the curriculum, how we do research, and how research and teaching don't necessarily need to be divorced. And this is actually looking at it in a very particular technical way. Now, out of this came this notion of DS106, which is an online class. Well, it's not an online class. It's been taught online, but it's actually a face-to-face class, too. It's a class that's happening everywhere. And what it is, it's basically this idea that when a student takes DS-106, they get their own space, they get their own domain, they set up their own web hosting, and they create their space. Everything they do in their own personal space feeds into what we'll call a mother blog, right? And that mother blog is all the work they're doing from all these different students. Now, what's interesting about this is, as you can see here, this space now allows for students in a class to see the work everyone else has done, but when you click on that link, it goes back to their personal site. They control it. Those comments are represented there, but when you click on the comments button, it goes back to the site that the student owns. Now, the interesting thing what happened with this is, after teaching it for 2 semesters, someone had recommended, why don't you open it up so anyone could take it, with the idea that they wanted to learn how to set up their own web host, how to work their own domain, kind of like practical things. So we did, and about 2 or 3 weeks later, 400 people signed up. What's even cooler is, a month before the class even started, people started doing assignments that were in the assignment bank that no one assigned.
Wow.
So we had 200 animated GIFs.
Wow.
You know, the stupidest technology ever, right? Like, you know, like, but they were doing like really elegant animated GIFs of stories and of movies. And it became kind of a process where people were creating, sharing how they did it, sharing out tutorials. I mean, it was amazing. And the class was still, hadn't started.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it was amazing. And so this is known as a massive open online course where you let anyone take it. And anyone can sign up for it. The students who take it at Mary Washington get credit, and the students who don't just get the experience of doing it and learning it. And maybe badges can fill in here, but I have my own problem with badges, so I'll leave it alone. But massive, this was not. I think when people talk about massive, they mean like 10, 50,000. How many of you heard of the Stanford course, the artificial intelligence? 150,000 people are taking that course. That's massive. 400 people, that's a massive. But I like that it's not massive. I like that it's controlled and there's a community around it. And of the 400 people who signed up, maybe 150 actually played along, and that's fine. And there's that artificial intelligence class. That's crazy. I don't know how they're doing that. One thing about the artificial intelligence class you got to think about is there's no social interaction. That doesn't happen there, which is a really interesting part, because DS-106 is all about the social interaction. So if I go here, this is where I think it gets interesting. This is the forum where any student or any person taking the class can submit an assignment. And then we say, look, do 4 assignments from the design, do 4 assignments from audio, and anyone can do it. And that's where you start to get the students designing the curriculum. They're actually critiquing what everyone's doing. And we just kind of came up with this as an idea, but then it took off. And I was a little bit, you know, my ego hurt, because no one did my assignments anymore. They're like, they suck. Whereas every other assignment your students created rocked. And it started for me to think, like, wait, maybe I'm probably better as someone who coordinates and brings this together than as necessarily the teacher, right? And here's a look at some of the assignments underneath design. And this one is a favorite. It's called the 4 Icon Challenge. This was submitted by Tim Owens, who actually was a student in DS-106, and he did so awesome that we hired him at UMW. He's now an instructional technologist. So this is also good for professional development and getting good employees. But that is actually a 4 Icon Challenge from The Big Lebowski. And so this kind of visual iconography that we ask students to work from is our kind of fragmenting the idea of visual storytelling. We don't want to hear about when you scrape the knee. We want you to play around with the visual rhetoric of the web right now. We want you to think about how to create this stuff. We want to think about how to produce stuff on the web, right, in the medium. And here's another one, 1984. Pretty elegant. This was submitted by someone who never took the class. They never even signed up. They just said, hey, I did one because I thought it was fun. See you later. I love that. It was like a drive-by assignment. How many of you ever get drive-by assignments in your classes? Like, oh, I just want to do one great assignment because I think it's cool.
Yeah.
That's trippy. And Peter Rowan from Australia actually did an assignment whereby he used his lawnmower to lawnmower DS-106 in his lawn, and that's a lawn in Melbourne, Australia. So how many of your classes have an insignia lawnmower in Melbourne, Australia? No one does. I know that. It's only DS-106. Now, is this stupid? Yes, but that's the genius of it. The genius of it is that anyone can do it and have fun and do what they want, but it engages a community. So DS-106 has this kind of fun idea that the community of creating and sharing around creating actually builds an idea of us as producers, of us as supporting each other in what we do, and as a community that breaks out of the idea of the individualized notion of competition, and this versus this, right? It's a group of people working together to learn a new literacy, and a literacy of the web. So DS-106 Radio was born of this, and I would like to talk about it, but that might be a better discussion for next week. So I'll actually leave that off, but we're on DS-106 Radio right now, so everyone can say hi.
Hi,
DS-106 Radio. And you can also say, I'm going to not let them hear. For life. For life? DS-106 Radio, for life. Are you ready?
Yes.
One, I'm three. One, two, three.
DS-106 Radio, for life.
See, that's our tagline. Don't ask me. The whole for life thing became this funny thing. It's like once you're in, you don't get out. It's like the cockroach hotel. It's like everybody keeps doing assignments. Like they can't shake it. It's like a sick addiction. And when the class becomes a sick addiction, you're doing something right, right? Like heroin isn't so important because it's not good. That didn't go over too well. Anyway. So this is Grant Potter. He's the man behind DS-106 Radio. I always have to give him a shout out. He actually... The third week of class, DS-106 Radio was not planned. The third week of class, he said, I have an idea. We could use a radio station rather than using Illuminate and all those other terrible tools, and I could do it open source and on a series of servers. And he did, within a week. So within a week, without even planning, because you made it open, and because you let anyone do what they want, people created things. And people did something that no one ever prescribed. And to me, that's a totally different notion of what a classroom should be. It should be a laboratory, right? The producer should be the student. And another student, Tim Owens, created a TV station. So now we have the vertical in the audio, the radio, and the horizontal in the TV, which means we control the airwaves, right? We own everything. We got the TV, we got the radio. Some people call it a media empire. I like to call it a media collective. But at the same time, this is kind of playing around with the notions of this open, this new web. This way of controlling ways of broadcasting and sharing is not a theoretical model. It actually is practical, and we can do it. And we can do it in a classroom that seemingly has no notion or objective. The objective is to create. Now, this is DS-106 TV from the Grand Canyon. What's nice about DS-106 TV, and that's happening right there, we're also on TV, where I am. You can go show the whole audience. But you can do it anywhere with any kind of app. You can do it from an iPhone. You can do it from an iPod Touch if you have wireless. You can do it from an Android. You can do it from your computer, right? You actually give the TV and the radio back, and you let anyone produce. Now, also, we have a Minecraft server that we played around with. It didn't go over too well, but that was just another space people could play with. And someone did do DS-106, and they actually developed a whole world. But I was never in it. And the fact is, I didn't have to be. You know, I didn't have to be like, oh, are you doing your work in Minecraft? People wanted to do it. Like, they don't care if I'm watching or not. And then this happened. The pedagogy of uncertainty. The Summer of Oblivion. Summer of Oblivion was based in David Cronenberg's notion of the Dr. Oblivion, who was actually a modeled on Marshall McLuhan. Dr. Oblivion is interesting. He's never talked to anyone for 27 years without being mediated by the television screen. So Dr. Oblivion will only come to you via television screen. And if he's on a television network TV, he'll be on it as a TV screen. It's very trippy. So like he'll be sitting down, he'll be talking to one guest, and the other guest will be Dr. Oblivion within a TV screen. Right? So this whole idea of being mediated was fascinating to me. So we decided, and it was me and everyone at DTLT, Martha Burtis, Andy Rush, Tim Owens, to actually create a character called Dr. Oblivion. I shaved my head. That's me, actually. I took this, and I came on and taught the class as a character. Excuse me, class. I was very boring. I was very focused on lecture. I was like, listen, this is what open internet is. It was just like, shut up. But then Dr. Oblivion went missing. And Jim Groom, the TA, came on and started teaching the class. And the class, like, students started writing me and being like, is Dr. Oblivion all right? Like, they didn't know that Dr. Oblivion wasn't real. And it was this trippy notion of identity and ideas about who we are. And this was created by a student, this animated GIF. And then Michael Branson Smith, who I'm glad is here because I have more to say about him, who's teaching a version of DS-106 right now. Michael, he's in the back, did this poster. And a bunch of people from DS-106 met up in New York City and put the posters all over the city. So what it became is an emerging alternative reality game. Like, who the hell is Dr. Oblivion? He's a fiction of the web based on a class that starts to blur the notion of reality and classroom. And that's a very beautiful poster, by the way. But it doesn't start there, stop there. Then we have students who got so into it who do the March of Time videos. So they were like, this is amazing. And they started saying, here's what happened in DS-106 Summer of Oblivion today. So check this out. If we get audio, hopefully.
News of the march. Sectionalism rocks the Oblivionite camp as T.A. Jim Groom goes mad with power and banishes DS-106ers on NAS. The family Oblivion bickers while DS-106 burns, and so clearly new leadership is needed. First martyr to the cause after the Oblivions is a robot, who's banished from DS-106 after questioning Groom's seemingly absolute authority. So let it be noted in the annals of history that DS-106 is hereby dissolved, its power over our minds illusory, and its message of total student domination illegitimate. From the ashes of DS-106 arises a new order, DS-107, led by none, controlled by none, for the benefit of all who seek relief from the oppression of the TA. We are the true heirs of the legacy of Dr. Oblivion.
That's the student.
We rule the world that our purpose is to depose the monster and see him displayed in chains for all to see. With that in mind, carry on the legacy of Dr. Oblivion with your radio and video assignments as we wait in joyful hope for his return to us. With Oblivion on our side, we cannot fail. And to all enemies of DS-107, seek not to bar our way, for we shall win through, no matter the cost.
Okay, so this is pretty awesome, right? I tend to be Jim Groom, and I start banishing students because they question my authority. I'm like, you question my authority? You're banished! And I'm doing this on live video stream. And the students are like, what? And the Twitter stream starts blowing up. And Alan Liddell, who did this video, is like, screw him. We're going to create our own class called DS-107. And he does this propaganda video, which the whole class is about, to get rally troops around the real leader, Dr. Oblivion, who's missing, and to banish Jim Groom. Well, it gets more complicated because the Summer of Oblivion camp actually comes and everyone's taken to a camp and many of the students are killed in the camp. And then you find out it wasn't Jim Groom or Dr. Oblivion, it was Martha Burtis, the TA who never was. But do you see how the class became kind of like the narrative it's supposed to be?
Right.
Kind of emerged as a story that the students were telling and controlling. For me, that was kind of a remarkable thing. And students are creating stuff like this that I couldn't do. They were in control. Michael Branson Smith, if you want to see a great post about this, actually went through and he took you through tweets using a tool called Storyify, through videos, everything about the whole narrative of the break in DS-106 to DS-107. It was amazing because we started to realize these tools as they came. And we found new ways to narrate a process that none of us were in control of. I mean, I was completely not in control. Third day of the class, I had shaved my head and went down, and my wife was like, what is going on? You were ugly to begin with. Now you're just unsightly. And I was like, all right. And then so by day three, I started to have real identity issues. Like, I didn't know if I was Dr. Oblivion or Jim Groom. So I told everyone in my office, I'm done. I'm going back to Jim Groom. I'm wearing my hat. I'm finished. They're like, why don't you make him go disappear and come back as TA Jim Groom? And then we were like a writing team. Every day we came to work for 5 weeks, and we did it. And it was radical to teach a class as if it was like an episodic show that the students controlled.
Wow.
Now, other people started to take on the identity of Dr. Oblivion. Students, people I work with. And so Dr. Oblivion became this kind of MacGuffin that everyone was having fun with. And it was actually really fun. Then Dr. Oblivion interviews Jim Groom. And we did a little cross-cut thing. And so what you can see here is this.
Watch this. It's trippy.
So we actually filmed this two times. Once with my hair cut, and another time with everything growing back. If it works, it will work.
Jim Groom, what happened?
Yeah.
Why did you banish the people from DS-106?
Well, I'm not really sure what happened there.
So you see, he has a, I won't let you go through the whole thing. It's kind of, I mean, I think it's funny, but you might think it's stupid. But at the same time, it's like this idea that these identities, students really related to them.
Wow.
And Dr. Oblivion became a figure that people after the class kind of held up as, you know, this figure of this mediated presence that wasn't any one person but was an idea for a narrative that the class was actually unfolding. Now, what's the coolest thing about DS-106 and this idea of the class taking on is that it hasn't died. This semester I'm not teaching it because my school was like, all right, I don't really know what you're doing, so maybe we should put the cools on this, because I didn't get any approval for anything. I don't know if anyone has taught a class as a character before. I think it's a cool idea, I just don't know if anyone's done it. But Michael Branson Smith is teaching DS-106 from York College, and they are killing it right now.
That's good.
Marissa, whose blog site is called Explains All, which I love, goes down to Wall Street, takes pictures, and makes assignment art from the work she did. She also goes down there and takes videos, and she talks about something that's happening right now, but also she creates art from it. And there's this kind of unbelievable moment we have where folks at CUNY who bring in a completely different identity to DS-106. And then we have another 40 students from Japan who just came on board. And they're talking about manga, anime, they're doing their own thing, and the site is becoming a space to share. What's unique about it is why it's good is that you create a community where students create stuff and they get feedback immediately from people at York, from people at Mary Washington, from people on the open web, but also from their professor. And it's like you're creating a community where other people can give feedback and openly kind of review each other's work. Now, I want to end with this. Luke Walter said this, and I think it's right. And I don't know if you know Luke Walter. He's not a particularly nice person, but he actually comes up with some really good ideas sometimes. And for us, this is kind of exactly what happened. We developed an open source publishing platform with the idea of getting people their own space and controlling their work. But what happened and what we're starting to see happen, and this really goes back to what Mike was talking about, is hopefully the work we're doing in this experimental space will gradually integrate back into the school's general ed curriculum, back into rethinking what it means for a student to create, co-produce, and research in unique ways, and ways that aren't just reinventing the old model, but are actually truly rethinking what teaching is, and how students, in many ways, control that process as much as any one professor should. So I really want to go away with, at least from this point, thinking about that. The critical examination of how digital tools are changing is something we're not even talking about right now. And you see how it's changing the world around us, between the Arab Spring, Occupy Wall Street, journalism, TV, you name it. It's everywhere, but why aren't we critically interrogating it? It is our obligation. And it seems like we're kind of dropping the ball often. But I hope DS-106, and I hope the idea of the student as producer married, suggests an alternative. And I really kind of want to just reiterate Mike Neary's point. And I think it's great, the student and producer point. The capacity for a student as producer is grounded in the human attributes of creativity and desire. And what's interesting is DS-106, as a model of student as producer, captures both the creativity but also the desire and drive to create and to share, which I think for too long universities have choked out of the equation. And I think there are ways now, both with infrastructure and with a new theoretical view, to introduce it back into the university and make it relevant again. With that, I'll stop.
You can open it up for questions.
Thank you.
Last one.
I would like to know, for students as producers, what would be some of the processes that I guess educators would follow to protect the students' intellectual property when they produce this research? Because a lot of students produce research and professors get a hold of it and they actually use it and they don't even attribute the research to the student or the idea. So
yeah.
I don't know if this relates totally to what you're saying, but.
We have thought about that, of course.
Right.
But if professors are exploiting students, then they're exploiting students. And that has nothing whatsoever to do with students producing.
Right.
Students producer is not about exploiting students.
Right.
But having said that, we do have a framework of intellectual property rights, both
okay.
for undergrad students and postgrad students, and in their relationship with academics. And of course, all of this is there's a much more progressive legal frameworks also that Joss and Jim might be able to say something about the Creative Commons and copyleft and those kind of things. So and maybe Jim and Joss want to say something.
Yeah, well, so as I said earlier, one of the first things that came out of Mike and I talking about Students Producer is this: are the values of the free culture movement, and you know, one of the most widespread forms of that is in the Creative Commons licensing, which is all about redefining intellectual property in a much more permissive way and a much more with so much more clarity than what it's usually how it's usually expressed. So that was very much the starting point of where we were in our conversation, and then out of that we developed this notion of an academic commons, and have been promoting this free culture, the values of free culture, ever since, really. And we've done one or two projects. Well, of course, we set up an open access institutional repository, which offers staff the ability to license their work under a Creative Commons license. And there's a general program of education around alternative licensing and open open access. Yeah.
Thanks.
Get Mike and Joss to talk a little bit more detail about the type of work that your students are doing. What's striking about seeing these two presentations together is that they're kind of very opposed models to achieve the same ends, which is encouraging students to make work. And I think we saw from Jim's presentation how that resulted in a certain type of work. And I'm curious if the fact that you guys have been kind of methodically institutionalizing the project of student as producers within the curriculum of the college, how has that impacted the type of work that students are doing?
Yeah. Well, I think the work was there already. I think my point is that there's this kind of work is going on in all universities. So the first thing we did was go and map what's already happening. So it's not like we're asking academics to do something new. They're already doing it with their students in all kinds of different ways, and very importantly in their own subject areas. So that's the first thing we did. So we weren't imposing a model on academics. We were trying to promote the kind of work where they were already bringing research and teaching together. And there's untold examples of this kind of work. And on the website, you can see there's a publication which the Higher Education Academy have produced, which goes through English universities, American universities, and charts all of this kind of work. There's work that's just come out of Macquarie in Australia, where they look at everything that's going on in Australia in this way. So, but just to give you one example of work that I was involved in when I was at Warwick University, and where we're using the same framework model at Lincoln, and that's a student-produced journal, high-quality student-produced journal, where the students are not only writing the articles, they're also editing it and managing it and shadowing with an academic. And the journal is called the Reinvention Journal, again in honor of Boyer, his Reinvention Committee, and that's now an international journal. It's probably going to be self-financing, we hope, and students from all over the world are submitting articles, which are then being reviewed by academics in exactly the same process that we would go through, and just as rigorous. And there's been four or five issues of the journal. There's many programs, as you know, in the US and also in the UK, where students are given an award of money to work alongside an academic on a research project. I think it was invented originally in MIT. We're doing all of that as well. So, you know, there's lots of examples. We're not changing anything. We're only encouraging and supporting academics to be academics and to find a way of bringing those two dysfunctional activities together. But at the same time, and I don't think that Jim and I are coming from the opposite direction at all, but I think what we are doing is we're trying to institutionalize the model. And that's the real challenge. And in doing that, to redesign the university. But if we haven't got the stuff already happening at the grassroots, it's never going to happen. It has to come from that work. But then we're supporting that from the top by redesigning the model in the way that Jim was talking about to promote that activity and to radicalize it and intellectualize it, because that's the essence of what scientific research work is. It's experimental, it's radical, it's challenging, whether it's sociology or chemistry or physics, that's the point, to critique the model you're working in. So, and to encourage academics to talk about their teaching in the same way that they talk about their research, and that excitement. So rather than sitting lecturing for hours, although lectures can be very important, and Jim gave a stimulating lecture, we don't want to get real lectures, but we don't want hours and hours and hours of lectures sitting in rooms like this.
And Jim, at the end there, said that your school has put the brakes on DS106 for a while. Well, if Jim was working at the University of Lincoln, we've got an institutional framework that encourages what Jim does, right? So
yeah. So
this is, you know, we're trying to promote it, but also kind of
precisely
care for it as well and grow.
Are there certain disciplines that have, where this project has taken off more than others?
No, I don't think so. I think, curiously, in the UK, academics, when they're generalizing and looking for a problem, say it could never happen in the natural sciences.
Yeah.
In the US, it's the opposite. It's happening in the natural sciences in lots of examples, and they say it wouldn't happen in the social sciences. So,
well, one of the examples, one of our projects was an open educational resources project, and that was in forensic chemistry. And as I said before, in the projects that I coordinate, I run, students are at the very center of it, and two students effectively produce all of the teaching and learning materials. Some of them, you know, were just straightforward PowerPoint slides that are used by their peers in their classes. But one of the students was a postgrad student in science journalism, and he went around the country interviewing well-known forensic scientists. He put together 5 radio shows that were broadcast on the university radio during National Science Week. So there are ways of doing it across different disciplines. And I would add that, you know, Mike's presented students producer from, you know, you're hearing it from its creator and from the Dean of Teaching and Learning, but as it spreads across the university, it's interpreted in different ways. So it's not, you know, it's a university, for God's sake. Everyone's got their own way of doing things. They interpret it, they challenge it. And so it's being picked up in different ways. And much of my work is, as I said, at the not in the classrooms, but it's at the institutional kind of service level of technology. And so, you know, the librarian, the head of IT, are all picking up students' producer and thinking, what does it mean to me? So in that way, it's having various effects.
And to build on, I mean, what you're both saying about, you know, this can't be done in this discipline, like digital storytelling, as soon as we kind of developed this, and this was many people, Martha Burtis, Alan Levine, a lot of people, Tom Woodward, came together to build this class. And they said, well, that's great because it's a digital storytelling class. You can do whatever you want. You know, we couldn't do this in our economics class. We couldn't do this in our geography class. We couldn't do this in our chemistry class. But the fact is so many of the assignments and so many of the ways in which they are creatively approached allow, like Josh was talking about it, for a scientist or a student of chemistry to do a radio program where they explain a particular issue, to do a video in which they kind of capture this. And this is about introducing new ways, at least from the way we approach it at Mary Washington, is introduce a kind of inspire new ways to kind of create a model of sharing and of teaching one another that students actually manage and control. And that, I think DS106 has been interesting because it showed us a lot of different ways to do that. And our job as instructional technologists, at least at Mary Washington, is to go into the classroom now to work with faculty to say there are new ways to approach this. And a lot of that is actually them as professors giving up a certain amount of control over defining how certain things happen, defining certain ways that people, this is the paper, this is how long it should be, here's the margins, here's the bibliography. I mean, that's just a prescription, right? That's not anything more than here, follow these steps, do this, and you'll jump through the hoop. We really want to level the playing field and say, here's a whole different way to kind of share and provide a way of looking at a topic, you know, and that's why the video, the TV, and the radio are so important, in my mind, is that why can't universities, particularly public universities like ours, have the means by which to share out the work the students create in different ways, whether it be audio video programs, TV programs? Why can't we be programming the web with great stuff? And why can't we define our classes as both a teaching and research marriage, so that when you come to a class, you come there to create something that's going to live on and other people can use and then mash up? That's the other thing about your intellectual property question is, we want to keep it open, everything in DS-106, although we wouldn't define, students define that for themselves.
Right.
But the more that's open, the more we can remash. And the more we can kind of start thinking of the individual, the individuality and the purity of any one product is actually always false. And it's always a matter of mashing up and the tensions between ideas. And one of the things that's great about that idea, as we see it played out in DS-106, is that students will actually mash up other students' projects. They'll say, here's your assignment, now take that assignment and then do this. And so they're logical extensions of each other's works. And I think when you have this idea of this is my property, that can never really happen in any fruitful way. And it kind of stymies any notion of kind of creativity and, I think, innovation around ideas.
Well, what I find is that a lot of professors don't take to the idea of students learning. Through the use of Blackboard and discussion board, sometimes they're very, which I know Blackboard is not fit this paradigm per se totally, but they're very reluctant for students to expand out very much or much outside of the model that they're giving them. So there's a lot of contention between professors and students, because I mean this is happening now in the room.
Yep.
And it's,
well, there's an interesting question there, and Joss, I'd be interested to see how you feel about this. Is like when you know the learning management system, it's separated from the theoretical idea of student producer, because that's the idea, and then how we do it through technology,
mm-hmm.
that could work in a lot of ways. But I'm interested in this idea of like the learning management space
mm-hmm.
does define, you know, like Foucault says with the, you know, the opticon, right? It does define this notion of control.
Right.
And the student is always already a user. Never a producer. They don't create anything. And when their semester's over, what do? Like, they delete their work. It's like, what better way to tell a student, I don't love you? It's like, you just get rid of their stuff. And I think that whole model is based on a notion of control, which I think is at the heart of the critique of student and producer. But it's like, one of the problems is Blackboard has become a way, but it hasn't been an articulated way of the definition of the actual architecture, right? That's really the issue there, is how do we open up the architecture?
They don't use the 5 C's of new media with it. There's a collaboration, creativity, there's like three of them. They put it in a vacuum for really solely their model. And when a student starts stepping out, it's very problematic.
I think you call them learning management systems over here. In the UK, they're called virtual learning environments, which I think is even more ironic because, you know, in my experience, no learning happens in them. They're a repository for PDFs and for PowerPoints, and people just go in to pick them up, and occasionally you get announcements. There are some attempts to use Blackboard, which we also have creatively, mainly through the extensions like the wikis and blogs.
Right.
But in my experience, because I followed in Jim's footsteps, and I run a multi-user WordPress network at Lincoln. And in my experience, people come to me having used Blackboard and been frustrated with it and said, you know, we want to do this, but Blackboard just isn't letting us, but we think that the blogs can. So, you know, that people are kind of, Blackboard is leaking and coming to the more open technologies.
I just want to say something, Jim. As you were talking, you were theorizing. You just slipped into the theorizing.
I hate when I do that.
And you were saying, these things can be kept apart. And I don't think they can be kept apart. That's the point. Technology is not a neutral, benign system. It's connected to a much bigger system that I think we have to try and think about both at once. And we have the language to do it, but we can't. I think if we constantly see them as being detached, then again, we're abrogating our responsibilities as intellectuals. We have to find a way of talking about them much more intelligently, in a much more complex way.
Yep.
And therefore, we have to theorize.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in a progressive way. It's not just a neutral technique.
But I think Jim's being a bit modest. In your blogging, there's clearly evidence that you're thinking through, you are theorizing what you're doing. I think you're extremely reflective about what you're doing.
But I have to go over the Atlantic to actually see how it makes sense. Like students producing.
Yeah, we're all learning from each other, that's
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
As what you're doing at the university level,
yeah.
Had repercussions on the lower levels of education? I mean, are you seeing results from like the teachers you're training?
Yeah, I think it's too soon to say, I think. But I think there is a movement in education in England to get students much more involved in the process anyhow. So students doing research, students actively being involved in the classroom in a very creative and productive way. So I think it's part of a wider movement. I don't think we're having any influence on what's happening in schools. But I think in schools they're already thinking about doing these sorts of things. So there's a general move in the UK, in the good schools, in the progressive schools, for these sorts of things to be happening. And even at the infant level, even in the very young schools, there's more of this way of teaching happening in the progressive schools.
Well, I guess we have that in this country too. It just hasn't found its way into public education.
Yeah,
and the public education is its own issue, right? Because then they pay tribute to a different god, right? The god of assessment, the god of metrics, and that kills any notion of students' power in the class.
Yeah.
It does.
We have that problem as well, and the things work against each other, but even so, there's lots of examples of progressive work. And I think at the senior, when students are age 18, and part of their assessment is to do an independent project, a research project, and that's become very popular in recent years.
I'll just quickly clarify. We talk about Students Producer is an institution-wide project, but it's also a received external recognition from the Higher Education Academy in the UK, and is also an externally funded project. So in terms of the impact of Students Producer on the UK higher education system, it has been recognised, it's been funded as a formal three-year project, and it's being quite widely noticed across the UK sector. And in terms of the project of Students Producer, we're just going to the second year of 3 years of that formally funded project.
Yeah. And it's getting a lot of publicity in the national press, in the Guardian newspaper, which you might know, the liberal leftist. We've been getting a lot of attention. And tomorrow there's an online web debate about student engagement, which is a big concept in the UK right now. How do we engage students in university life? And the central issue, or the example they've used for us all to talk about online, is from 12 till 2 tomorrow, UK time. No idea what time that is.
6 to 8? Is it 5?
It's in the morning.
Yeah,
from 12 till 2, there'll be an online conversation about student engagement, and Student Producer is the exemplar project. So it's having an impact in the HE world, a big impact. And as Joss was saying, we are funded by the government, and we're working with 6 or 7 or 8 universities in the UK and Australia and Maastricht in the Netherlands. But of course, they think they know who we are. But as I've tried to explain, we're much more ambitious than that. It's not just a nice teaching and learning. As important as they are for improving the life of students, it's about reinventing the European university. And there's a huge movement in Europe right now, a protest against the knowledge economy and what that implies for the university. So we're part of a radical movement of protest, academics and students, in a moment of crisis for higher education. And there's something very significant going on down on Wall Street, down everywhere. And we feel we're a part of that, and we want to be a part.
Sorry, I jumped in before you.
Oh, yeah.
Sure, I was just wondering, that kind of paradigm shift, how do you support that among faculty, that difference? It's one thing to think, like, oh, I could empower my students, but it's a whole other thing to actually either have the apparatus to do that or have the willpower to step back or whatever it happens to be in particular setting.
I know, I know. Well, we're doing a couple of things, I think. We said at Lincoln that all teachers or those supporting teaching and learning will are required to have a teaching qualification in HE or some form of professional recognition, which is very unusual in HE in the UK, because although the professionalisation of teaching has gone on for the last 10 or 15 years, there still is much resistance from research-intensive universities to do that. So where we've asked, it's now a requirement, and as a part of that requirement, we're going to be training or educating, as we prefer, our teachers across the whole university, and we've got some extra resource to do that. And in the process of education, we'll be talking about all of these things and getting Jim to come over and talk to us. And so that's one level. At another level, we're trying to create what we're calling a teaching academy within the university, which is a more informal idea. So we all find ways of supporting each other as teachers. So we build, it's not an expression I like, communities of practice, but that kind of idea. And again, we've got a bit of resource to do that as well. So a more informal way of doing that. Another way of doing that, we have some small amounts of money, which we have a competition for academics and students to apply for. We have two competitions, and in those competitions we're asking the students to redesign the curriculum alongside academics. There's about £3,000 to do that. It's not a lot of money, but it's not bad, actually, and that's very competitive. Just a little bit of cash goes a very, very long way.
Particularly in academia.
Yeah, so we're doing that as well.
At the level of, in my work with technology, through Student Producer, we put a proposal through the committee system last year and had had our work recognised and consolidated into a new group that is technology for education group, which is meant to be a cross-university inclusive group to encourage staff and students who have an interest in the use of technology for education to work with us in developing a different, improving the use of technology across the university. And alongside that, we've been resourced. We have a recent graduate student intern, and we've been given the equivalent of $30,000 to hand out bursaries to students.